You're listening to the Arsenal for Democracy, forging and preparing a new generation for leadership. Now, here's your host, Bill Humphrey.
For 91.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark in the great state of Delaware, I'm Bill Humphrey, and thanks for listening. I'm coming to you on January 5th, 2015 from my studio in Newton, Massachusetts. This week, Nate joins me to discuss Congressman Steve Scalise's stubborn white supremacy, U.S. policy on Cuba and North Korea, and rising Islamophobia in Germany and Sweden. All that is coming up right now on Arsenal for Democracy. Arsenal for Democracy is usually recorded in studio every Monday and is available for download on Wednesdays at arsenalfordemocracy.com and from iTunes. We air the show in Delaware on 91.3 FM and stream it from WVUD.org on Wednesdays at 6 p.m. Eastern. Follow us on Twitter at AFD Radio or like us on Facebook. This is the Arsenal for Democracy. Welcome back to Arsenal for Democracy. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. Joining me in studio again, as usual, is Nate. Nate, Happy New Year.
Thanks a lot, Bill. Great to be here.
So the first story that we're going to talk about, we're sort of playing catch up on this episode with a few stories from the past few weeks since we've been off for the holidays. The first story that we're going to talk about is about the House Majority Whip in the United States House of Representatives, Steve Scalise, congressman from Louisiana. And we're going to talk about the fact that he is apparently a white supremacist. So the official line on this is that the congressman did not realize what he was at this event that was uncovered back in 2002. That doesn't really seem to hold much water, as we'll get to in a moment. But let's just backtrack to what the initial story was. So this was broken on a Louisiana blog, senlamar.com. The headline was, House Majority Whip Steve Scalise was reportedly an honored guest at 2002 International White Supremacist Convention, and apparently tipped off by someone, which of course made all the right-wing bloggers, who constantly are getting tipped off to things by people, say that this was some sort of a hit job by someone, you know, an angry office seeker or something like that, you know, somebody who was mad at Scalise or had lost him in the past. Anyway, basically this blogger went back and tracked through all these posts and comments and stuff from a few years span 2002 to a few years later, basically looking at Stormfront, which is a notorious white supremacist website. It's basically the oldest
catch-all racist anti-Semitic Nazi forum.
Yeah, and one of the like more notable things about Stormfront, if anything is notable about it, is that it definitely takes very seriously the notion of a sort of a united white supremacist front spanning both United States and Europe. So all of these factors sort of come together at this 2002 event that was held in Louisiana, and it was organized by David Duke, and he was the leader of this organization called Euro, the European American Unity and Rights Organization.
Bill, do you think they did a lot of outreach trying to bridge the divide between like Italians and Irish people or anything like that? Just some good old-fashioned inter-Euro-American communication?
I suspect not. Like the Italians probably got left out because they were Southern Europeans.
Oh, that's a good point. Well, then the Irish probably would have been on board either, so.
Yeah.
People have pretty like high qualification, but it doesn't really seem like too many people are actually white these days. I mean, just according to some of the criteria I've seen on there.
Precisely, so. Yeah. I mean, they basically, that's the thing. All of its constructed identities and like this, you know, there was also a billboard just recently that went up in Arkansas by a local KKK group talking about, you know, being proud of your white heritage or having white pride, and it's okay, it's not racist to have pride in your community and stuff like that. And it's like, okay, but this is a purely constructed identity that like essentially exists as the dominant thing in the country.
It exists to oppress those who are not falling in the, you know, necessarily qualification or categories.
Right. Anyway, this Euro thing had and this convention had all been organized by David Duke. David Duke was actually a Louisiana politician himself. Originally, he was a Klan wizard in the KKK. But, you know, he was very famous nationally, you know, had run for president at various points. Was on the cover of Time magazine. He was one of the biggest politicians in the state of Louisiana. He had actually been in the state legislature in Louisiana just a few years before Steve Scalise, who at the time of this 2002 convention was a state rep himself. So everyone in Louisiana knew who David Duke was. That was not, that's not in question.
This is 2002 as well, so well after his sort of rise to prominence in the area.
Exactly, but also not far enough out that like everyone had forgotten him.
Yeah,
or
exactly.
Like that, right?
I mean, it was sort of maybe towards the end of his like wax and wane in Louisiana. I don't know.
Exactly. I mean, yeah, I would agree with that characterization. But there's basically no way that Steve Scalise wouldn't have known who David Duke was. So then at that point, his claim to not knowing what he was at would depend on like that he had never, you know, had direct contact with Duke. And Duke was apparently in Europe at the time doing a simulcast with the European side of this convention, you know, through the magic of technology, as the, I think this blog post referred to it. Like, maybe he didn't, you know that Duke was involved with this. Maybe he was only contacted by Duke's friends, but I think those guys were relatively well-known as well. But the other bigger thing, I think, is that in order for you to go to a convention that that's referring to itself as European-American Unity and Rights Organization and talking about white civil rights, I mean, the whole thing was branded as a civil rights and heritage convention and stuff like that, talking about organizing and learning how to be active on protecting white civil rights, you have to have at least a very strong sympathy to the idea, the blatantly false ideas we've talked about before, that white people are somehow oppressed in order for you to go to a convention like this. Like, you have to think, oh yeah, white people need their civil rights protected too, before you can go to a convention that's all about protecting white civil rights. Like, you have to already be in that mindset, even if you wouldn't necessarily go give a speech like that yourself. And apparently he was kind of giving sort of a tangential speech, as we'll get to. But like, you have to have that sort of pre-existing notion that there's an injustice that needs to be rebalanced here.
Yeah, there was some things that came out relatively recently, just various discussions people had had with him in the past. And basically it seemed like he was sort of marketing himself as a David Duke light, or a friendly David Duke. So he was telling people that he had some of David Duke's ideas and values, but without, quote unquote, the baggage. So maybe some of the more openly racist and KKK affiliation type things that might turn more moderates off. But he was sort of marketing himself as the friendlier, cuddlier David Duke. And, you know, that obviously is part of the reason why he's at that conference. I mean, there's no way that he didn't know what exactly was going on there. It wasn't like, oh, this, you know, I'm just... He later came out and claimed, you know, I'd just go speak in front of anyone at that time. I didn't really know or care. And
yeah, he claimed he was so concerned about like protecting our fiscal soundness that like he had to get the message out to anyone who would listen.
But as we see from the contents of his speech, Bill, I mean, that sort of puts a lie to that. I mean, if you expand on that.
Yeah. So apparently I'm going to try to pull up a quote here from somebody who had attended the convention. You know, so they're talking about like how this, you know, in general, the convention was about the diminishing view of where America stands on individual liberty for whites, blah, 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 tactical strategies, things like that. Then says, the meeting was productive locally as State Representative Steve Scalise discussed ways to oversee gross mismanagement of tax revenue or, quote, slush funds, end quote, that have little or no accountability. Representative Scalise brought into sharp focus the dire circumstances pervasive in many important underfunded needs of the community, meaning the white community, at the expense of graft within the Housing and Urban Development Fund, an apparent giveaway to a selective group based on race. And then a few years later, this same commenter, when Scalise announced that he was running for the first congressional district, said, those that attended the Euro conference in New Orleans will recall that Scalise was a speaker offering his support for issues that are of concern to us. I suppose that if Duke does not make the election for whatever reason, this gentleman would be a good alternative. And, you know, again, this is somebody else's sort of third party spin on it. But again, apparently a major focus of this supposed budget speech and, you know, fiscal soundness or whatever was the Housing and Urban Development Department. And as we know, you know, this tends to be associated in many circles, certainly circles that are sympathetic to these white supremacist views, tends to be associated with housing for Black Americans, for Latino Americans, and various other minorities. And so if Scalise really did focus on the idea that housing and urban development was the area that we needed to cut, you know, and that's a tiny portion of the overall federal budget, you know, and I'm sure the state versions as well. If that's what he was focusing on, that's, I mean, pretty much the loudest possible dog whistle you could do.
I mean, I think it's audible to the human ear as well there, so.
And so it just, like, this is the problem that everyone's having trouble getting past, and I don't think they're going to be able to, about this claim that, you know, oh, I just had no idea what I was talking about, whatever, whatever, whatever. I mean, in general, a lot of this sort of fiscal responsibility stuff, you know, I believe that there are plenty of conservatives who have gotten, you know, who firmly believe that, like, their focus is on fiscal responsibility and fiscal conservatism, and, you know, that this is what conservatives are all about, and that's fair. But I think that there's been very clear evidence that a lot of them, especially the ones who came from the Democratic side originally, you know, who were Democratic conservatives, those guys have a very specific agenda. They tend to be concentrated in the South, but also have crept into the North. But basically this idea of, you know, it's our money, it's not their money, and you know, they're trying to take away our money and give it to people who don't deserve it, people who don't, you know, work and that kind of thing. I mean, for all the, you know, BS talk about post-racial America or whatever.
Well, Bill, I would like to say that there has been a large rise, and I see it all the time, whether, you know, it's on the internet or wherever, of white conservatives playing a victim card, basically saying, you know, that, oh, black people are getting various favors, or, you know, either from the government or from, you know, society, things like that. And it's just, you know, you sort of look at it and you're just like, are we even looking at the same world here? There's another point I want to bring up, Bill, and it's that the timing of this speech. So remember back in 2002, and I don't know the exact dates of these, but remember we had the controversy over Trent Lott speaking at Strom Thurmond's, I believe it was 100th birthday party, saying that America would be a better place if Thurmond was elected president. Of course, he had to resign as Senate Minority Leader at the time, and there was a sort of a whole kerfuffle about that. And this, I think, is, I mean, it's not really that far off in terms of the importance of the position that is, you know, the person is in, sort of the dog whistle type language that's being used, and, you know, whether it's just the fact that, you know, maybe these guys were, you know, sort of just trying to expand their constituencies and appeal to these groups that have these deep-seated sort of racial animosity. But, you know, when it comes down to it, those are the people that you're trying to court, and those are the people that you're beholden to if you're elected. So if you're going out and giving speeches to them, I mean, it stands to reason that you're at least sympathetic to their message, or you're willing to accept some of their message and put it into practice. So, and of course, the fact that he's, you know, talking about housing and urban development and all sorts of key issues around that situation, it really raises the question of, you know, what does this guy actually believe in? What sort of policies is he trying to undertake as the House Minority Whip or Majority Whip? So, you know, it's, I think this guy should resign. I think it's imperative for the Republicans that he resign, just in terms of a public relations move and a way of trying to improve their party's minority outreach. But if he stays, I mean, that's just, I mean, that's perfect for the Democrats. That's a campaign, that's like 10 campaign ads right there.
Yeah, and to go back to the Trent Lott thing, and then I'll bring this back around to the point you're making here. Again, to the timeline issue, I just looked this up. So this convention that Scalise was at was in May of 2002. Trent Lott, who was the Senate Minority Leader at the time, about to become the Majority Leader, he gave a speech at the 100th birthday on December 5th, 2002. As Nate mentioned, this is the Strom Thurmond one, the one about we wouldn't have had all these problems if Strom Thurmond had been elected, blah, blah, blah. This gets out almost immediately. By December 20th, he announces his resignation effective January 3rd, 2003. And that's when Bill Frist took over. So that was like in like the span of 3 weeks, essentially. Not even. It was less than 3 weeks and he was out, right? And in contrast here, we're looking at a situation where Scalise gave a race-baiting speech at a David Duke event in David Duke's state, his state.
And we found out about it because of Stormfront.
Yeah, and we found out about it because of Stormfront. Those people were super enthusiastic about it, which that also says a lot, you know, because I don't think that their primary concerns are fiscal responsibility. I think that it's other stuff, and if fiscal responsibility helps them get there, then they're on board with it, which, again, that's the big red flag here. You know, Trent Lott even had to go, like, give an interview with BET, apparently, like when that had happened, right? And like, where is this? No, Scalise.
I think that was at like the height of BET too.
Probably too. You know, and in contrast with Scalise here, right? So at the time he, you know, he's 36 years old or whatever. He's a lot less well known. There's a lot of relatively crazy state representatives across this country. So that's not that much of an outlier. But then, you know, eventually gets to Congress and then becomes the third highest, most powerful position in the House of Representatives, the House Majority Whip, the person who's enforcing party discipline on, you know, all these important votes and stuff like that. And instead of having to, you know, go give an apology on BET or whatever, instead he gets John Boehner to forgive him. Like, I'm sorry, John Boehner has the authority to forgive you for the fact that you were at this white supremacist convention? And Boehner's explanation, well, I believed he was sincere when he said that he didn't know he was at, like, that thing. It's just like, no, he clearly knew what he was at. I wanted to pull another quote from these that Sen Lamar had found from these Stormfront accounts and these various, like, promotional information about this. This is what this convention was about, okay? The event will be an all-day training workshop designed to teach the most effective and up-to-date methods of civil rights and heritage-related activism. Again, civil rights and heritage-related activism. Presentations by Euro-National Director Vincent Breeding, who I think was the guy that invited Scalise to this, Euro-Virginia State President Ron Doggett, and other excellent activists will show you exactly how to become an effective civil rights activist in your community using simple, easy-to-follow steps. This workshop will also be an opportunity to meet other activists from around the country and forge new friendships and working relationships. This was very, very clearly a white supremacist thing. And there, you know, that like the unfortunately the right-wing media, I've been following this on Twitter, they've basically convinced themselves that this is all a hatchet job by the liberal media and that this, you know, that this didn't have like, oh, he didn't know what he was at, or that he was actually at a different event that was in the same hotel, you know, like all kinds of theories to explain this. And basically all of them have been debunked. And it's like, how do you walk into an event like this not understanding what it is? Even if you just gave a speech on fiscal responsibility or whatever, but you mysteriously focused it on one of the branches that supposedly helps minorities, you know, like, this is a problem. There's no way around that this is a problem.
And I think it's a problem for the Republican Party, too, because it seems like it's growing increasingly difficult for them to, I don't know, like, capture the base that is sort of roiling with various racial grievances and things like that. And this is something that we've seen maybe take a little bit of a spike over the past couple months with various incidents around the country, shootings and whatnot. So it almost seems like they're having trouble sort of keeping the lid on that element of their base, while at the same time appealing to it and trying to draw from it, drawing electoral strength and, you know, advertising and, you know, campaign contributions, things like that. So it's really a tough spot for the Republicans because on the one hand, I think the smarter amongst them realize that they're really going to get nowhere with a white base in the next couple decades. While on the other hand, their white base is so extreme that sometimes even the appearance of not, you know, pandering to them or trying to outreach towards, you know, Hispanics or something like that is viewed as almost a betrayal and can have serious repercussions for any Republican politician who attempts that sort of outreach. And then, of course, you have the Scalise as you just cycle back to supporting the base and sort of trying to retrench that sort of animosity there. So, I mean, it's a tough spot for the Republicans, and I don't really see it changing really all that soon. I don't know.
Yeah, no, I don't. I agree. I don't think that he's going to lose his job over this. And you can question, okay, well, is that because, you know, they agree with him, or is that because they feel like they can't fire him? Like, you know, any number of reasons, he's going to stay put. And like Nate said, Democrats are going to be able to use that against the Republicans. But, you know, this is just their new normal. And I agree with you, Nate, that they can't, like, the longer that they double down on this particular base, the harder it's going to be to then switch gears later when they absolutely can't win with just that base. It's going to be hard to switch gears to appealing to minorities, but they also can't, they feel like they can't jump yet. They can't make that jump because the other base is still so huge. I'm not saying I'm sympathetic. I'm just saying this is the position that they're in. It's,
well,
it's not
interesting.
A good one. So,
it's,
yeah,
it's sort of, there are some fissures there, and obviously we're not Republicans, so, you know, we have a little bit of glee along this. But at the same time, it's just from a, you know, sort of political science perspective, it's interesting to see how these how this will be resolved. And this is something we've talked about for a long time, Bill. I feel like, you know, back in high school, we were talking about the various divides between the social conservatives, the fiscal conservatives, and the neocons, and sort of how all that, there was a unity and then sort of a fracturing that happened during the Bush administration. And you wonder if, you know, they will ever again be able to completely sort of paper over those differences and achieve a unified Republican Party, because a lot of their sort of aims are almost completely at odds a lot of the time. I mean, immigration, you know, various fiscal issues, foreign policy when it comes to the conflict between the neoconservatives and sort of the more Ron Paul populist nationalist base sometimes. So there are differences there.
Yeah, I mean, you're right. George Bush was kind of the last one who was able to unite the, you know, the business conservatives, the defense conservatives, the evangelical conservatives, the libertarian type conservatives or whatever. And it just kind of all broke apart under his administration. And, you know, some of that's his fault. Some of it's just sort of trends that were happening. You know, and he tried to, you know, appeal to the business conservatives by passing the immigration reform. But then that didn't work because the, you know, the sort of racist elements opposed that. Like, there were a lot of, and, you know, and a lot of people are saying, you know, Jeb Bush is the only one who could potentially unite that again, right? He's got a very, but like, he's also got some problems and probably can't get through a Republican primary. But the reality of the situation is there aren't really any candidates at this point who could survive a Republican primary and win a general election in 2016, given the map that's going to be in play. Even if you come up with a, Nate and I were looking at this a few weeks back after a show, we were looking at the map. Even if you give a really like very generous map to the Republicans, like you give them North Carolina, you give them Florida, you give them even Iowa, make it really easy for them, the Republicans in most scenarios still end up losing, because they're, whoever they nominate, whoever makes it through that primary process is going to be too extreme to win, you know, the white conservatives in Ohio, but also the Latino conservatives in Colorado and Nevada, and also the sort of beltway big business conservatives in Virginia. And in order to win the presidency, Republicans are pretty much going to have to, in addition to locking down, you know, Florida and North Carolina, and those aren't even sure bets, they're going to also have to win Virginia, Ohio, Nevada, and Colorado, or at least like three out of those four, something like that. There's not a lot of scenarios that work out very well, and somebody's going to need to somehow be able to appeal to white Christian conservatives and non-white, you know, probably Christian conservatives, Latino conservatives in some of those Western states. And it's looking very hard to come up with scenarios that put that together.
And then a lot of the other Republican candidates have some other problems with them. I mean, we've got Rand Paul.
Yeah, I mean, like Rand Paul and Scott Walker probably come the closest to, like, bridging some of those groups. Like, they can get, you know, the libertarians and the big business people, or they can get Christian conservatives.
Two of four or something.
Yeah, two out of three or two out of four, something like that, you know, depending on how you count it. But there aren't really people who can reliably get most of those people, enough of the groups together to be able to win the nomination and win the general election.
And maybe the ones that would come the closest maybe don't quite have the resume or the experience in, you know, sort of high profile office that would make them particularly attractive in a general election. So,
all right. Well, Arsenal for Democracy is going to be back in just a moment. You're still listening to Arsenal for Democracy. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. Still in studio with me is Nate. We're going to talk now about Cuba and the policy shift that was announced after our most recent episode, before the holidays. President Obama announced a deal. There was a prisoner swap with Cuba, and also that some of the relations will be eased with Cuba. There will be some, it will be a little bit easier to travel there, and, you know, various other things that were going to be made a little bit more relaxed. Obviously, the embargo still can't be lifted without congressional approval. That doesn't seem like it's forthcoming. But, you know, we'll see. Maybe that'll be changed. There are some Republicans in the new Senate majority and everything, like Jeff Flake. I think he's been particularly active on trying to change Cuba policy. So there's definitely some positive signs I think, that are going to come out of this. We've definitely talked about U.S.-Cuba relations before on the show. We talked about some of the, you know, failed CIA plots there, Henry Kissinger's obsession with Cuba, things like that. There have been various attempts to, you know, alternately overthrow the regime or befriend the regime. Not everyone agrees, but most people agree that the policy at minimum has been a complete failure in accomplishing its goals, if its goals are actually to force the regime to leave or resign or whatever. That's definitely failed. You can raise some questions as to whether or not the actual purpose was to keep state-owned agriculture production in Cuba from competing with corporate agriculture production in Florida. It didn't really matter when it was all American corporations that were running things in Cuba, as well as Florida and Georgia and those kind of places. But if you look at the exports and the major crop productions and stuff in Cuba, it lines up pretty closely with the American Southeast. So after the Cuban Revolution, a lot of the Americans weren't able to profit off of that anymore. And then we got sad about that. So there's an embargo now.
No more like Havana, Vegas type situation. Like, from what I heard, it was a sort of a haven for like gambling and all sorts of fun stuff like that back in the day. So I wonder if maybe we'll be going back to that at some point.
Right. And, you know, so this policy change, again, it's not a huge sweeping policy change, but it is slightly relaxing it. I think a lot of sort of sensible, rational people are looking at this and going, this policy doesn't really make sense. I mean, for one thing, it's just a U.S. embargo. There's a few other countries that have similar things because they want to have good relations with the U.S. You know, Cuba's not allowed to be part of the Organization of American States, I believe. But other than that, everyone else in the world pretty much has relations with Cuba. You can travel there easily. They have trade there. It's hard to have an embargo with a country if only the United States is participating. I mean, it's a major factor because they had close ties, but it's like there are other countries that are having ties to Cuba. This Cuba policy hasn't really worked, I think, pretty clearly. Like, it hasn't, you know, and it's not even like there's not an embargo line that hasn't been there since the Cuban Missile Crisis. So it's not like the U.S. is preventing like other countries from shipping in goods or buying things from Cuba. So this has pretty much just been sort of a trade barrier with the United States, which, again, has been damaging for the Cuban economy, and I would argue has actually made the Cuban population more dependent on the Castro regime, but it doesn't seem to have been working very well. There are also various goofy plots by the USAID that we've talked about both on the show and on the arsenalfordemocracy.com blog. You know, there's not much that needs to be said about them. They're really silly. They haven't done anything. So I think that this is a recognition by the Obama administration that this policy really wasn't working and needed to be changed. But again, it's going to take congressional approval to really roll this back. But, you know, a lot of this has been made possible by sort of changing attitudes in the Cuban-American community, except the Cuban-American community in Congress. They were still quite upset about this. One poll quote that I have here is, quote, "I know the Cuban regime and its true nature better than this president does," said Senator Marco Rubio of Florida, whose parents left Cuba before the Castro regime. I'm not sure how he knows more about the Castro regime than the president does, since neither of them are from Cuba and neither of them has family there.
Or something,
he probably read a Wikipedia article on Spanish Wikipedia or something. I don't know. You know, there's a lot of these sort of irrational reactions. I know that Senator Robert Menendez from New Jersey, he's sort of been sort of the most rabidly anti-Castro. Also, I think his parents additionally were not from the Castro era. They left before then. Again, there were a lot of exiles who left before the Castro regime because of the oppressive American-backed regime. And nevertheless, they are obsessed with, you know, human rights and all that stuff in Cuba, and saying that this is the only thing that's going to bring human rights to Cuba, even though, you know, a half century later it has not done so. You know, Menendez has made himself a target in many ways. He got caught up in a fake sex scandal because the Castro regime planted a story in a conservative newspaper that said that he had had a relations with an underage prostitute or something like that. And it turned out that was completely made up, and the conservatives just didn't fact check it because it seemed too good. And so they didn't, you know, they didn't remember that the second half of that is too good to be true.
Yeah.
You know, and Menendez last year in 2014, as Russia was invading Crimea, said that actually the biggest geopolitical threat in the world was Cuba. So, I mean, like, at a certain point, they've kind of become unhinged about this issue and haven't really accomplished anything. I don't know. Nate, did you have any thoughts on this policy change and the reactions that we've been getting from various sides?
Yeah, I mean, it's just, this has been a long time coming. It's been very clear for a while now that the U.S. embargo towards Cuba has not been productive, effective, worthwhile, anything. Bueller. So, I mean, we're not exactly talking about a policy that's been particularly successful. And I don't know, it just seems like the time has come that, you know, the Cold War has now been over for a very long time, like a quarter century. So, I mean, I think it's time that we sort of just, like, tossed everything to the side, try to figure out. I mean, Cuba is going to be the 51st state at one point, so we may as well, like, start trying to have decent relations. I'm sure there's a lot of tourist economy that could be good for the people of Cuba. Rich Americans coming down spending their money there is probably not going to be too harmful to Cuba. Maybe they can get some new cars now, although I don't know if I want that because their cars are kind of cool. So
yeah. I mean, it just, yeah, at minimum, it seems like if you're really that concerned about, you know, quality of life in Cuba and making sure that people have better lives, like, this hasn't worked to do it. So why not try the economic route? Well, I mean, that's what China's done, right?
Yeah, this has in fact hurt the quality of life of the people of Cuba. So, I mean, letting them into the free market probably is going to have some, I mean, there probably will be some negative effects on, you know, various types of Cuban businesses, things like that, if they're, you know, all of a sudden competing with goods that have been, you know, up to international standards for years now. But at the same time, I mean, that's sort of the process that has to happen in order to, you know, fully integrate Cuba into the global economy. And
I think they're a WTO member as
well. Yeah, I mean, it's
so,
not like it's going to be like a tidal wave washing over this poor little island.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's going to take some time.
One of the changes that was made in this policy was that the amount of remittances that you could send back if you were a Cuban-American, you know, had family members in Cuba, that has been increased as well. And that's definitely usually a very, very effective way of distributing, you know, sort of development aid informally. That has helped a lot of countries, making it easier and cheaper to send back more money. And that's been very difficult because of the embargo and various other restrictions. So this is going to make it a little bit easier to do that as well. But, you know, I just, it seems like this policy hasn't really been working in terms of, you know, human rights and, you know, democracy and that kind of thing. You know, China has also provided an example of how you can improve quality of life and make life better for people, even if you have still not a democratic system, not a good human rights system, which I'm not saying is like the ideal thing that we want to have everywhere or whatever, but that, you know, the world is not an ideal place and you want to try to get it as, you know, as good as possible, I think, for average people, especially if the policy doesn't work in the short or medium term. You don't want to just keep it going in the long term just because. Also, it's puzzling that they obsess over, you know, sort of the human rights record of Cuba and that kind of thing, which, again, I admit that it's bad and that they arrest a lot of people for political reasons and that kind of thing. But the fact is the U.S. has a lot of allies that do that and that we don't have those kind of restrictions on. We barely implemented any punishments at all for the Egyptian regime, which overthrew a, you know, at least semi-democratically elected government that was really trying its best despite being thwarted at every turn by military-backed and Mubarak-backed, you know, institutions. And then the military, you know, they massacred, this was the Guardian's report from Human Rights Watch back last year in August, that they killed 817 people in a Tiananmen Square-style massacre. And we then, like, that was in 2013. A year later, we're giving them attack helicopters and stuff like that. And say, oh, well, they ordered them a long time ago. Okay, but Russia ordered battleships from France a long time ago, and France isn't giving it to them. Like, you know, so this is the issue here, is you can't say on the one hand, well, this is unacceptable, they're a totalitarian regime with an abusive human rights record and all these political prisoners, while at the same time you're giving all these weapons and support and money to, you know, Egypt and Saudi Arabia and all these things. I know that's cliche to say, but it applies very clearly in a situation like this. The Cuban regime is not worse than many of the U.S. allies at this point.
Well, I think the problem is we've been mischaracterizing the Cuban regime a little bit for a while now. I mean, I don't know. I mean, if you read up on the history of sort of the Cuban Revolution and, you know, everything that's gone on since, there's been tremendous human rights abuses, right? There's been, you know, various executions, political prisoners, all sorts of things like that. But as you said, there's not like recently in the past, maybe 15, 20 years, has there been sort of, as you said, like a Tiananmen Square style event?
Yeah, it's not a reign of terror.
Yeah, I mean, it's not quite the same thing as we've seen in some of these highly volatile Middle Eastern countries where there are revolutions and then the secret police are putting down the revolution. And, you know, so you just sort of wonder if things are maybe a little more stable there, a little more ready to be pried open, if, you know, if we can put it like that. So there's all these, I mean, just the problem, yeah, and like you said, Bill, the problem has been, for the past 15, 20 years, we have Republicans continuing to take a very hard line on Cuba past the point where it's even reflective of reality of what's going on over there now. So, I mean, I think the time is now to begin sort of slowly expanding relations with them and, you know, hopefully reach a point in the future where Cuba is a democratic country, where it's, you know, a prosperous nation. You know, it's very easy to go down there and for Cubans to come to America and you sort of have a greater cultural relation rather than just sort of these like refugee bastions in South Florida where they're, you know, particularly hostile towards Castro and, you know, want the U.S. government to take a super hard line on anything to do with Cuba. And we're already seeing now, you know, you have another generation of Cuban Americans who, you know, they do have ties back to Cuba and, you know, they want to continue this cultural exchange. And, you know, so it's not like let's cut them off and never talk about Cuba again. It's let's bring Cuba into the 21st century. So hopefully that'll happen.
Yeah. And while we're, you know, kind of thinking about revising this Cuba policy, thinking about the end of the Cold War, I think we need to also think about the situation in North Korea. Obviously, that's also been in the news a lot due to the controversy with the interview movie. And we still don't know for sure if they were involved in the hacking there. But, you know, that's something that I've been thinking a lot about in the past several days. That's another sort of Cold War relic. And they're certainly a much more dangerous regime. They're certainly a much more abusive regime. We get all these reports out about the millions of people that are, you know, enslaved in camps, that are starving, that sort of thing. And I don't want to downplay those at all. However, you know, I think a lot of that comes from the isolation. It's not, you know, some of it's just a really abusive regime, but some of it comes from these isolation policies. And, you know, China has remained allied with North Korea, even though they don't really like the North Korean regime, because they're concerned that there's going to be millions and millions of refugees streaming across into China if that regime falls. We need to start thinking seriously, in my opinion, about how we disentangle the situation in North Korea, how we wind that down in some way. I would argue that a lot of the, you know, hack attacks or missile tests or weird nuclear tests, like a lot of that is kind of acting out by the North Korean regime to try to get attention and to try to build themselves up as a threat. I'm not saying they're not a threat. They have the capacity to destroy Seoul in about 30 minutes, you know, which is the capital of South Korea, and they can do that with conventional weapons. So they are a threat, but they also build themselves up as a threat and periodically do, you know, random artillery fire and things like that to try to remind the world that they're a threat. Why? Because they need food aid and things like that from the outside world. They cannot survive without assistance. So they're basically creating leverage opportunities to get that stuff. And so, you know, you have to really stop and ask at a certain point, is the current policy where we basically sort of isolate them and then they do something, so then we give them some goodies to make them stop, and then, you know, the cycle continues.
They like, attack some island or something.
Exactly. Yeah. Some uninhabited island that's disputed or whatever. Like, at a certain point, you have to ask, should we really be holding out these resources like that? Is that an effective tool to actually accomplishing anything? It seems like it's not. And, you know, they're, you know, it's a isolated, paranoid regime that won't talk to anyone, blah, blah, blah. And they're committing all these atrocities. But then some of these atrocities are because of their isolation and because they're not being given these things. You almost have to wonder what would happen if we just said, okay, how much food do you need? Here's all the food as a goodwill gesture. Maybe the regime would just hoard it and use it to increase their power further by, you know, controlling distribution and that sort of thing. But, you know, I don't know what the right answer is on North Korea, but I've been wondering a lot about this, about why, you know, maybe we should just try to give them a lot of food and stuff that would help make life not miserable on a daily basis for everyone, or at least a little less miserable. And I think that's the thing, that there comes a point where you've kind of been doing something for a long time, and then you start doing it to continue doing it, and you lose sight of why you were doing it, or what the objectives were, or what the point was, or when you're supposed to dial it back. And so with these sort of Cold War relics, that's something to think about, sort of rethinking. And I think it's also going to become important going forward with situations like Russia's annexation of Crimea. I definitely support the sanctions we're seeing right now. But also at the same time, I recognize that it's probably not that likely that Crimea is going to be returned to Ukraine anytime in the next, 15 or 20 years, probably, barring some sort of really unforeseen event. And so then you have to wonder, okay, well, are we going to keep these sanctions on Russia for, 20 years, 30 years, 40 years or whatever? At a certain point, probably no. Probably we're going to roll it back. Whereas, we don't do that with Cuba and North Korea because they're so small that we can get away with not doing it. But again, I support Russian sanctions now, but we're going to have to remember to not lose sight of the sort of coercive element to them, the coercive and punitive elements, and saying, okay, this isn't causing any change. This isn't meant to be just a punishment. It's supposed to achieve some other goal. And if it's not doing that, you kind of got to think about, well, maybe we need to do something else.
Yeah, I mean, it just sort of seems like North Korea's in a corner just poking everyone with a stick, periodically in order to receive some sort of reward or just get people to notice it again and, as you said, provide food aid, things like that. I mean, North Korea has a very large black market presence, you would say. There's they're heavily involved in counterfeiting and various types of things, smuggling. I don't know how much they're involved in drugs, but I would imagine somewhat, probably some weapons as well. But yeah, as you said, they're almost extremely isolated. Okay, so you're talking about the potential, the reason China is, concerned with propping up the North Korean regime is because they're afraid of all the refugees that could come into China should the North Korean regime fall, because obviously they're going to get the hell out of there at that point. You just got to wonder if there's a way that we can sort of open a dialogue with China about trying to figure out a way to wind this situation down, as you said. I just don't think North Korea can continue to exist for the next 50 years. It's not a real country. It's not a nation. It's a sort of 50s era, just
massive prison camp.
Yeah, they commit massive atrocities, sort of have the kings living in their palaces, lording it over the peasants. I mean, that's sort of the situation that goes on there. I mean, it's not all that far away from, sort of Tsarist Russia in some ways, or, it's ridiculous. So, and it's so completely unstable that you just have to wonder, what is the future of North Korea? Is there a future where it sort of is absorbed into South Korea, or part of it is now China, or, they sort of set a timeline to hand over power? What is the outcome here? I'm sort of asking you, I'm sort of trying to brainstorm out loud, because I don't think it can survive another, even 25, 50 years, but it may just do that because, we don't have any other good options.
And the South Koreans, at least as official policy, want the, countries to be reunited and sort of absorb North Korea as part of South Korea. And that's sort of the same policy as West Germany had toward communist East Germany. But the situation's not the same because it's been so completely divorced from reality and so economically destitute. It's been hard enough for West Germany to integrate East Germany economically and sort of raise standards of living there over a, now 25-year period at this point. It's hard to imagine South Korea or China effectively mitigating the fallout of this, which again means we need to start thinking very seriously now about what that looks like, so that if there is a sudden opening or a sudden toppling, if he gets overthrown by some officer or somebody, just somehow there's a regime change and somebody says,
I'm gonna
reform everything, I'm gonna throw open the gates, that could happen at any moment. And everyone needs to have a contingency plan for what to do about that, because it's going to be chaos if there's no sort of plan in mind for how to handle that. All right, Arsenal for Democracy will be right back in just a moment. Welcome back to Arsenal for Democracy. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. Still in studio with me is Nate. We're going to return now to a topic that we cover quite frequently on the show, sort of rising Islamophobia and sort of European populism and extremism in Europe. Several weeks ago on the show, we had talked about, or maybe a month or so ago now, we talked about sort of the German soccer fans' role, I think, in anti-Muslim protests. Those have sort of spread well beyond those bounds now at this point. And Sweden is another area where there's been some rising attacks. So we want to talk a little bit about that. So what we basically saw in Germany was that in Dresden, there was a record-breaking protest, 17,500 people, according to police estimates, rallying against Islam and the supposed Islamicization of Europe. This was just basically a giant hate rally that was framed in terms of, you know, like we were talking about in the first segment on this show, you know, European identity and that the Western white European identity is being lost and we need to protect those civil rights, etc. Now, you might think, okay, well, this is just some crazy extremists and maybe it's getting a little bit bigger, but it's not such a big deal. According to a poll conducted by Forsa for Stern magazine, which was reported on by Newsweek, 13% of Germans said they would attend an anti-Muslim rally if one were held in their own community, and 29% believed that the rallies were justified, even if they wouldn't necessarily participate. And, you know, so that's 3 in 10 at that point, almost a third of the population. That's pretty troubling there, certainly well over a quarter. And Chancellor Merkel finally felt that she had to make a comment about this in her New Year's Eve speech, sort of like the State of the Union for the German leadership. She said that the protest leaders had, quote, prejudice, coldness, or even hatred in their hearts. And she said that, you know, that their real message underneath all the fancy talk about European identity and all that is, quote, you don't belong because of the color of your skin or your religion.
Maybe they could start a Euro-type group, just to throw the reference back from earlier in the show.
And she also said, there is no place for stirring up hatred and telling lies about people who have come to us from other countries. And this is a lot of this is related to the sort of generous asylum policies that have been used a lot in the past few years because of the Syrian crisis. And that sort of connects over to the situation in Sweden, which is another country also in the European Union that has had very generous asylum policies. So, Nate, why don't you walk us through kind of what we've been seeing there?
Yeah, and just I'm going to quote a couple figures from this very interesting New York Times article that came out, I believe, a couple days ago, January 2nd, talking about the rise of anti-Muslim sentiment in Sweden. And we see that, for those that don't know, Sweden, of course, is a relatively homogenous country, but there's a large population of refugees. So roughly a fifth of Sweden's 9.6 million people were either born abroad or immigrant parents to Sweden. So a lot of these people have been refugees from places like Somalia, Syria, you know, Middle East, a lot of Muslims coming in. So this has led to sort of a rise of racial tensions and sort of anti-Muslim sentiment. And according to some people, the rise of the Sweden Democrats, who are sort of a populist right-wing anti-immigrant party, many have said that the rise of them has made racism more acceptable. There's a very almost segregated system in Sweden where, you know, you have large almost ghettos or neighborhoods where a large amount of immigrants are there or unemployed sometimes. And, you know, this obviously is a recipe for sort of clashes, racial tension. We've seen fire bombings of mosques. We've seen, you know, sort of like various types of graffiti, disturbances during Ramadan, you know, all sorts of these, you know, whether it's attacks or just various things to just make them not feel welcome at all. And then, you know, we have the political situation, if you want to expand on that a little bit.
Yeah, so, you know, I think it's an interesting contrast that in Germany you get this bold statement from the chancellor from the center-right party saying that this is not okay, this is not acceptable. And the center-right in Sweden has said, well, we would never work with them, we would never enter a coalition government with them, you know, these right-wingers. But they also just haven't really done that much in practice to sort of help the center left maintain control against this sort of right-wing threat. There were elections back in September. The Social Democrats, who are the mainstream left party, they won that election, but they didn't win a majority. Even with the Green Party, they couldn't form a majority coalition. That makes it very hard to pass something like the budget. If you don't pass the budget, you have to go back to early elections, which were likely to make the right wingers win. And that was the concern. Their budget didn't initially pass. And so they called, early elections for the first time since like the 1950s. And those have been now canceled due to a deal that was struck with the center right. But the center right basically sort of pulled a, almost like the debt ceiling type deals that we've seen in the United States, the sort of Tea Party wing of the Republicans extorting the or even the mainstream using the Tea Party wing to extort the Democrats for various concessions. This is a very similar situation here. In order for them to survive and not go to early elections, the center-right opposition said that their budget had to be passed by the center-left government, this sort of Social Democrat Green Party coalition, this year, and then in future years that it would be the center-left's budget that got through. They lost those elections. They had been in power for 8 years. We saw income inequality going way up in Sweden, one of the fastest growing in the world for among the advanced economies. And 70% of Swedes in polls before the election in September said that they did not support the privatization agenda, the sort of extremist, you know, hardline neoliberal agenda that was being pushed through by the mainstream party, the so-called moderate party. And then they're the ones who get their budget through because the Social Democrats don't want to risk early elections that might help this Swedish Democrats Party, which as of the September elections is the third largest party in the country and might, you know, potentially be so powerful that they not only control the balance of power, but actually are, you know, have to be in the coalition government in order for there to be any government at all. That's extremely troubling, especially as you said, with these, you know, we've seen three major arson attacks just in the last several weeks on Swedish mosques. This is a very serious threat that we're seeing, and I don't really like the fact that this so-called moderate party, the mainstream center-right party, is basically extorting the center-left instead of saying, we'll help you do whatever it takes to keep out these extremists, which is basically what the center-right and center-left in Germany have done. They've made that deal, and that has to do with German politics and German history as well. I mean,
there were a couple things that happened. I don't know if you remember, Bill.
Certainly, but you know, I think that Sweden should be looking at that example and saying, we've got to keep these extremists out at all costs.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, there's, you know, as you mentioned, a couple firebomb attacks. There was one in Uppsala, which is a large city in Sweden, and just a couple others. And I'm just reading some quotes here that talking about how, you know, completely has sort of shaken the, you know, and if anyone has ever been to a Nordic country or, you know, ever read anything about them, they're characterized by sort of a tight-knit sense of community. There's, you know, there tend to be very small countries, but there's, you know, generally a social harmony there. And we're seeing that very fabric just being ripped apart, burned, destroyed over the fact that, you know, you have this rising anti-Muslim sentiment, you know, and it's not just in the U.S. It's in large places of Europe, too, because there's obviously maybe more Muslim refugees coming to countries in Europe. And this is really clawing at the fabric of Swedish society because they're struggling to deal with, or at least some people in Sweden are, sort of the multiculturalism that has really arisen in the past couple of years, because whereas once it was just, you know, Swedes.
Yeah.
And maybe a couple Finns from the north or something. Right. And then all of a sudden you've got these people who like grew up in Syria or Sudan or Somalia. And
so these ideas of multiculturalism are now becoming realities, and some people apparently don't like that.
Yeah, and exactly. And, you know, we've seen a backlash against multiculturalism from far right groups in pretty much every country in Europe, it seems like. I mean, whether it's Danish People's Party gaining prominence in Denmark. We've seen issues, obviously, as you said, in Germany, France, long history.
The true Finns in Finland.
Yeah, there's the UKIP so in Britain. So it's not just limited to Sweden. It's a problem that we're seeing all across Europe.
All right. Well, Nate, thank you so much for joining me here on Arsenal for Democracy to talk about this issue and the other issues we've been talking about today.
Thanks a lot, Bill.
And that's all the time we have this week. Thanks for listening to Arsenal for Democracy. Tweet us your comments at AFDRadio or email AFDRadio@gmail.com. The show is available for download from ArsenalForDemocracy.com on Wednesdays. You can also hear it on the air in Delaware from 91.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark every Wednesday night at 6 p.m. Eastern. Special thanks to my voiceover man, Justin. You can follow his work at the Digitized Ramblings of an 8-Bit Animal from 8BitAnimal.com. You can get additional commentary at ArsenalForDemocracy.com daily, as well as links to articles discussed today. From my studio in Newton, Massachusetts, I'm Bill Humphrey, and I approve this message. Good night.